Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, this is John Mullen at the Guardian Book Club talking to Louis de Bernier about Captain Corelli's Mandolin. I tried to sort of describe in the first of my columns on it for the Guardian, but I adopted a rather academic label, I'm afraid. The polyphonic novel, I called it, but the sort of method of using an extraordinary kind of combination of different narratives within the novel. So third-person narrative and first-person narrative, but also letters and sermons, and we move around, but even in the third-person narrative, we're with different characters at different times. Mm. I just wondered, I suppose, why that's quite kind of risky way of telling a story, or telling this particular story, appeal to you.
Well, it's risky because it can confuse the readers.
Yes.
But from the point of view of me as a writer, it's just more interesting doing it like that. If you're writing all those first person passages, but as one minute you're a young woman, the next minute you're an old man, and the next minute you might be Mussolini doing a monologue. It's a bit like being an actor without having to go on the stage. It's putting yourself into somebody else's shoes and thinking and feeling what you think they might have thought and felt in that situation. And I just found it much more interesting to write like that. I don't often write stories which are simply a linear narrative. I start to get bored with myself. I want more variety than that. And the other thing is, linear narratives, more often than not, are either one person's narration all the way through, or they're from the point of view of God, you know, the author as God, who is omniscient. And you can still have those passages in the kind of novel I write. There are still bits which are from God's point of view, so to speak. So I suppose being opportunistic, taking every chance that you can to make it more interesting both to write and to read.
Does that mean that in the process of composing and constructing it, you are taking quite kind of local decisions about, as it were, where to go next? Because when I'm reading Captain Corelli, I suppose, I mean, it's the method you describe involves having quite short chapters, quite a lot of quite short chapters, and at any given point I don't know where the next chapter is going to take me, I suppose.
No, one of my chapters normally takes me one day's work, so. And I've realised that, and the next day I go through it again, the day after that I go through it yet again, and probably print it out for future reference. And I've realised that the amount that I like to write in one day is roughly the amount that readers like to read in one sitting.
Yeah.
It's just a happy coincidence. So,
Alex Garland said that about his novel The Beach, where the chapters are all about one page long. So he obviously...
Well, his readers have shorter attention spans than mine, actually.
So, with these chapters with different characters, different styles, different sort of... They take you'll go from a sort of, you know, a really kind of gruesome account of... written in the first person and by an Italian soldier fighting and seeing all his kind of comrades dying around him and sort of rotting in foxholes, to bang, you know, quite a kind of idyllic little, as it would seem to the contemporary reader, little passage with Dr. Yanis writing his Catalonian history. I mean, do you do, you know, this... I mean, when Kafka wrote The Trial, he wrote all these little bits, but he sort of shuffled them around and then he put another bit in between two bits, as it were. So they all had a sort of separate existence, a lot of his chapters, before.
I have an old fashioned attitude to chapters, which is that they are each a self contained short story. There's no point having chapters if there is actually no break between one bit and the next. And I tend to write all of the bits that I want about one particular story. For example, the chapters, let me see, about, I think about the Albanian War. You know, I think I wrote them all in one go.
Right.
But I can't remember exactly what I did with Captain Crowley's Mandolin, to be honest, but with my more recent novel, Birds Without Wings, I wrote all of the various storylines separately, and then I cleared the furniture out of my living room, and I just laid all the chapters on the floor in rows. And I went through these rows, sorting them into an order that made some sort of sense. And then I put it together as if it was a novel, read it through, and then filled in what I thought were the gaps or the lacunae and so on. And so it turned into a novel like that.
Right.
In my first novel, I had three stories leading into one. And I wrote each storyline separately and then just, you know, alternated them.
And you'd say the risk of it is that the reader might become confused. I suppose another risk, perhaps a more subtle risk, is which you seem to take rather... I don't know, I forget this if I'm right about this, but you almost seem to be taking it deliberately in Captain Corelli, is that the kind of focus on and sort of allegiance to a certain character or a group of characters can be scrambled. And actually, obvious thing to say about Captain Corelli, I was reading it, you must have meant this, I got to page 97, now where is this Captain Corelli? I mean,
yes.
You know, and then on page 100, exactly, he's mentioned, his name's mentioned, and then he's still not there, you know.
and then he leaves early.
Yes, he does. He appears first. He appears first. I'm sorry, I have to do this because this is a kind of showing that I've actually done some work.
Yeah, okay.
On 100. He appears first on page 157.
Yeah.
And then he leaves. Oh, I've forgotten where he leaves. I've written it down anyway. But he leaves at page 350 or something.
Mm.
Yeah. But I mean, he's held back for a long time as if you're sort of. The central character, as if you're kind of playing a bit of a game. I don't know. Is that accurate or not? This kind of person who'll be at the centre of the novel, and yet he keeps not being there for a long time.
It is amusing to tease the reader a bit. I sometimes do that on purpose.
Yes.
But I when I did my master's degree at London University, I was studying. English language and literature in education, and I had to read a lot of literary theory, and although I did a degree in philosophy, I'm not the sort of person who would normally read a lot of literary theory, but I actually enjoyed it a lot, and I picked up a lot of tips from postmodernists, you know, the idea about having polyphony is one of them,
or
you know, all those sorts of tricks that I do employ. You know, I would be quite happy to have a chapter which is, say, an advertisement or a shopping list. I just think of myself as writing old-fashioned novels in a postmodern way.
So you have actually been directly influenced by the sort of seminar room in a way.
I suppose so, but I was doing most of that work on my own. Yeah. If any of you have been to a university recently will discover that the staff are pretty much absent and
absolutely
you do everything on your own.
No,
so
there are exceptions.
So in your solitary researches, in the absence of staff, you come up with lots of interesting things. And I mean, for example, one of the things I read was Umberto Eco's notes on the name of the rose, where he talks about how books are largely constructed by the reader rather than the writer. And that's a point I take very seriously. I know that he's right, because for example, I get letters from academics or from people doing an MA or doing their A-levels, and they're obsessed with things I didn't even know were in the books at all. I don't know how I got onto this.
the influence of sort of literary theory, for want of a better phrase. It's funny because it reminds me a bit of what I know. It's not a similar book exactly, but except it is in its combination of sort of narrative ambition and commercial reach, which is David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, and he said, I don't know if you've read it, but I mean, well, it's a sort of it's not a polyphonous work. It's a nest, but it's a nest of narratives, and they're all in different genres and time zones, and da 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 da. And it's like a kind of more, it's like a neater version of, and a much, much longer version of Italo Calvino. Mm. And he said, indeed, in a Guardian article that he wrote, he said, I did an MA in modern European literature. And I got really fascinated by this Calvino book. And I thought, I could try something quite like that. And then Blow Me Down, it becomes a Richard and Judy book club book of the year. But I mean, it's a strange thing, isn't it?
That sort of,
because academic criticism on the one hand is kind of the last 25 years has made itself largely unintelligible to any normal reader. And yet novelists maybe have been quite influenced by it.
Yes, I mean, I have to say, I've never been remotely influenced by Lacan, because I can't understand a word of it. You know, this sort of post-Freudian French complexity. I mean, the French, as far as I know, are the only people who still have any respect for Freud at all. But so I gave up on Lacan very quickly, but I was interested in structuralism for quite a long time. And I look on it in the same way as you might look on, you know, your past Marxism or something. It was a stage worth going through and also well worth leaving.
Well, let me to leave it, to depart from it, and the sadly jaundiced memories of academic inattention that you.
No, I was lucky because I was at university when I was slightly more than 30 years ago. I feel sorry for students who go to university now and get no attention whatsoever, and they have to pay for it.
Yes, mine all have one-to-one tutorials, but anyway. a different thing, which is kind of more often kind of commented on, and I guess it's an obvious, it's something that sort of know-all kind of reviewers said after Captain Corelli had been so successful was an obvious part of its appeal, though I doubt that it was obvious initially, which is a sort of locality. And I guess, I mean, your first three novels have kind of South American settings. And Birds Without Wings is Anatolia. But thinking about the particular sort of island, I know that it's partly your own, simply kind of comes from your own experience and knowledge and biography. But apart from, I mean, in a sort of fictional way, I mean, what made this a kind of good place for a novel?
The answer is simply that I found a good story. I mean, I think like most British writers, I'm interested for the most part in good narrative. In other countries, they're more interested in style, but I think the British like a good story. And I had the first three novels were indeed set in Latin America, and that's because when I was a young man, I spent a year in Colombia living in the countryside, and I was just the right age for that experience, and it completely changed the way I think and the way I operate. So while everyone else was reading Martin Amis, I was reading Latin Americans, you know, which accounts for me being, I think I'm a bit of an anomaly in British literature, that my influences aren't the same as other writers. But after three Latin American novels, I'd had enough of it. I'd had enough of the magic realism. But I still liked the political realism, and I still liked that jaunty sort of Baroque style that a lot of them go in for. So I held on to those. I was going to write five Latin American novels. The fourth one was going to be about a dictator. But at exactly that time, all of the Latin American republics, with the exception of Cuba, democratized. So the book would have been a complete anomaly. No, it would have been anachronistic. So I thought, okay. I had, at that time, I had a girlfriend called Caroline who, and with every summer, I used to get in my Morris Minor Traveller and travel with her around France, camping. And one year she said, please, can we not go to France anymore? So I said, okay, you arrange it. And she actually decided we were going to Catalonia. And it was just a happy coincidence. When we got there, the moment you get on the tourist bus, you find the tourist guides apologising for the lack of nice architecture. And they say it's the earthquake in 1953. So what got me interested actually was the earthquake. And I only found out later about the occupation by the Italians and the Germans and so on. So it was a stroke of luck. I mean, your stories usually are a stroke of luck. I mean, I was told a terrific ghost story in Buxton last year by a vicar I happened to have dinner with. So I said to him, "Can I have it?" He said, "Yes." So I wrote it. I didn't really, in a sense, make any of it up.
And he told it as it were, a true story.
Yeah. So the story from Catalonia, it sort of just landed in my lap, and the same sort of thing happened, but with Birds Without Wings.
Well, that sort of what you were saying about magic realism and kind of doing that and slightly leaving that behind. I mean, one of the things that interests me is how in this novel and in this place, in this locality, it's kind of almost, you may have left it behind, but there's kind of traces of it. I mean, one of the things happens in the novel, and everybody who's read it will know, is that there's a sort of running vein of allusions, not just in your narrative, but sometimes in the minds or even the words of some of the characters to Greek myth.
It's absolutely packed with references to the Odyssey.
Yeah.
Yes, I deliberately sort of pillaged Homer.
Yes. So it's a kind of... So, although it may not be a novel full of sort of spirits exactly, it's a novel where the characters, even I think the priest, use pagan myths, supernatural stories, to kind of understand things that are happening to them. Well, that's where it seemed. Mm. It seemed to me, and Dr. Yanis, is it a central character? Anyway, he's the character you first meet. Through whom you get to kind of know this world. He is a sort of, isn't he a kind of, you say he's naturally a pagan at some time. And when the Italian soldier Carlo dies, he has a sort of Homeric, gives him a kind of Homeric burial.
That's right. I mean, racial theories are a bit absurd, but Greeks seem to me often to divide between the Hellenes, who hark back to ancient Greece, and that's what they consider to be their inheritance. But Dr. Yanis is one of those. By far the majority of Greeks are actually nostalgic for Byzantium, which was the Christian Eastern Empire, and there's not a trace of Hellenism in them at all. They might call a street Aristotle Street, but actually it's meaningless to them. But for a minority, people like Dr. Yanis, yes, they look back further than Byzantium.
Yeah. I also wondered if perhaps I'm trying to be over ingenious. I wondered if you were doing something rather kind of clever about with the magic realism, because it's almost as if, well, there's all these kind of things which are in a magic realist novel, and maybe in one of your earlier novels, would undoubtedly be sort of supernatural events. So Saint Gerasimos brought out, and the nuns bring all the mad people, and one of them's supposed to be cured.
Yeah.
And now tell me if I get this wrong. One of them, who's called Socrates, you know, they all think he is cured.
Yes,
because he shows some of the most thin symptoms of rationality. Mm. But meanwhile, at the end of that chapter, another one, Mina, sort of apparently is really, and sort of. I mean,
They do that ritual twice a year, where you pass the mad over the body of the dead saint Gerasimos, and one or two of the people sometimes get better, which proves what we already know, that madness is in the mind.
But it's quite a sort of you do these quite teasing things, which make me think you do another teasing one where which is quite important to the plot, where Corelli turns up after the war.
Mm-hmm.
He turns up, and he sort of turns up annually.
Yes.
And Pelagius sees him, or at least on some of these occasions sees him, but decides to herself that it's a ghost. You know, that she's decided that he must be dead, and this actually confirms rather than contradicts it.
That was one thing that Greeks really objected to, actually. About
did they?
They said there is no way that someone could turn up in your village year after year without everybody knowing. So you can think of that as a bit of magic realism.
Yes. And was it? Would it be?
But sometimes you put in faults or inaccuracies on purpose. I mean, there's another one where I wanted. What's his name? Carlo, the big Italian.
Yes.
I wanted him to effectively to save Corelli's life by standing in front of him at the firing squad. Now, in real life, that wouldn't have saved Corelli's life because a bullet can go through a brick wall. So I knew that was wrong, but I wanted it as part of the romance of the narrative.
Then did people kind of pick you up?
No, I'm the only person who's ever pointed out that's wrong.
Okay. Maybe I could. I mean, I should ask you because, well, maybe readers wanted to. But I should ask you about some of the sort of things, the historical things that some people did object to or get angry about, and about the sort of representation of kind of what happened. Particularly, I guess. Well, I may be wrong, but because I got it second hand, I read newspaper reports about the people who got crossed rather than.
Actually, it was the Guardian and the Observer got fixated on this.
Yeah, and was it was mostly the representation of the sort of the communists
of the communist resistance.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was it that sort of so exasperated everybody about, or the a few people about that?
Well, the Guardian sent someone called Seamus Milne. I don't know if you know him. They sent him to Greece to tell all these old geezers that I'd insulted them and to ask them what they thought of me insulting them. So they all said, oh, we're really insulted. And the Guardian and the Observer reported on that. From the accounts that I had read of the Greek resistance were initially mostly from the British point of view, because the British had sent liaison officers over to coordinate the resistance. Not surprisingly, the communist resistance didn't want to be coordinated by the British, because as far as they were concerned, the British were as bad as the Germans. They were a bunch of capitalist fascists, and they couldn't wait to have a go at us as well. My initial accounts that I read, I suppose, were, as I say, pro-British and biased against the communists in that respect. But in large areas of Greece, the communists did behave atrociously. For example, they actually exterminated the royalist resistance, who you would have thought would be more or less on the same side. There was one leader called Aris, who was notorious, a sort of brigand. Now, my mistake in writing the book was in assuming that the communists were the same all over Greece. When the Guardian and the Observer sort of kicked up this fuss, I obviously was forced to look into it a lot better, and I realised that the Elas weren't actually very much controlled from the centre in Athens at all. So it wasn't a matter of policy being horrible to people; it was down to local leaders. So a woman from Epirus told me, "Well, where I was, the communists were marvellous. They even gave us drama classes."
Being a sort of the nicest thing they could possibly do in Greece.
So where I was wrong was in assuming that they were the same everywhere. They clearly weren't. I think that the misbehaviour was in various patches of Greece.
So you hadn't expected the novel to be a kind of contentious or controversial one. You were surprised when, because Greek. I mean, I've got quite a lot of Greek friends and. I mean, Greek people I know get quite kind of passionate about politics.
Oh, they certainly do. Yes.
I mean, more. I mean, quite blood curdling. Except they don't. I think the people I know don't mean it. But I mean, they become quite sort of impassioned about.
Yes, because there were several periods of terror. There was the German terror, followed by the. What they called the Red Terror, which was those communists who were misbehaving, followed by what they call the White Terror, which was the revenge of the winners of the Civil War. And so you had three separate periods of terror in which the degree of bad behaviour was fairly equivalent. And when this has happened, what you have is a legacy of bitterness and hatred, which is really very difficult to kill off. You've got the same situation in modern Spain, where the only way people cope with the legacy of the Civil War is by trying not to mention it. But they all still feel furious about it. And I think the same is true in Greece. There's still a lot of very angry socialists in Greece, and there are still a lot of very angry royalists.
Let me ask, I was open it to everybody else. I just wanted to ask you one last question, which is sort of about all your novels, actually, including Birds Without Wings, but sort of focusing on Captain Corelli. I mean, in all your novels, they're actually very... I mean, your novels are enjoyable often for their kind of... the luxuriance of their vocabulary. But actually, there are hardly any characters in any of your novels who even can speak English, and even some of the ones who can, in the course of the novels, rarely do. And as readers of Captain Corelli will know, there's a sort of great moment where Dr. Yanis, who is the most, I guess, articulate and sort of bookish of the characters in the book, where he does actually start speaking English. And at the moment where he starts speaking English, his speech goes all funny because you realise what you've been reading before in English is actually supposedly Greek. Mm. And there's a lot of this going on. There's an English character who speaks classical Greek, which Louis renders as Chaucerian.
Yes.
You know, Willon my am coming in.
Yes.
It would seem that, we're used to that. We accept that, you know. We read sort of I, Claudius, and they're all speaking in Latin or something, but they're not. They're speaking English. But it seems as though that's something that you kind of relish almost, the thought that all the opportunities for sort of translation and mistranslation that seem to be going on in a way throughout your fiction.
Yes. When I was studying philosophy at university, one of the obsessions back then was about the impossibility of translation. But that aside, what I've always tried to do is write English that's a little bit reminiscent of the language that the people would be speaking. So in my Latin American novels, I've tried to some extent to keep a sort of slightly Latin word order or Spanish word order.
Right.
I tried to do a similar thing with Captain Corelli. Dr. Yanis, and Greek doctors are notorious for the complexity of their speech and so on. So I've got Dr. Yanis talking about an exorbitant auditory impediment with the P in the ear. You know, it was much, much harder doing Birds Without Wings because the Turkish language is different again. For example, in Turkish, you don't distinguish between he, she, and it. So you can't sort of write English as if it was Turkish, really.
So in the novel in Captain Corelli, you actually when Dr. Yanis is speaking Italian, his English is a bit different from when he's speaking Greek.
Yes. Yes.
Who are?
I think so.
Because usually kind of novelists who try to do that. I mean, famous novelists. Great novelist Dickens does it in A Tale of Two Cities. Tells to tell you when they're speaking French, but he makes them sort of say "Hold upon thee, varlet," and things like that, which is how you know they're French rather than English.
Yeah.
But he usually kind of forgets it after about two or three sentences. So you,
well, one thing you can do is leave in the odd swear word or obscenity or exclamation from the original language, which doesn't need any translating.
Yeah.
So it just gives. It's a cheaty way of giving local flavour.
Yeah, that's like George Eliot in Romola, which all happens in 14th century Italy. She just, at the beginning of each paragraph of dialogue, somebody says two words in Italian.
Yes.
And then after that, it's all in George Eliotese.
Yes.
enough of me. Would anybody here like to ask Louis, or tell Louis anything, or ask him a question?
Can you just say something about the mandolin?
I know Italians are really fed up with this stereotype, but if you ask it in Greece what it was like being occupied by the Italians, what they remember is, well, not just mandolin, but mandolin and guitar music, sing songs late into the night, certain amount of drunkenness, football, flirtation with girls. Whereas What they remember about the Germans is that they spent most of the time marching around to brass bands. If you go to the junk shops in Athens, they're still full of abandoned German military brass instruments. But in the Ionian Islands, where the story is set, the mandolin is still a very, very popular instrument because it's bang next to Italy, and some people still speak a sort of Italian dialect. The Italians themselves, the majority of the good mandolin players and the music actually comes from the south. It's not something that northern Italians associate with very much. But I suppose I put it in because that's really what the local people there remembered. And during the time that I was writing the book, I'd had a mandolin for years, but I actually started to learn to play it properly to get myself in the mood. And I listened to a lot of mandolin music on my CD player. It's one of the things that makes Pelagia fall in love with him. He's practicing early in the morning, and she wakes up listening to this beautiful music that he's playing, and she admires the way that his hands move on the fretboard in this sort of magical way. So I think one of the things Arthur Schopenhauer said about music is that it's a transnational language. It's something that's comprehensible all over the world without you having to know any words. And in the way I thought of it was like that, that Corelli's music was one of the things that made his heart or her heart accessible to him.
Your epigram seemed very well chosen. I'm just wondering if you could, certainly the one in Birds Without Wings rendered me motionless in a bookshop for about 2 minutes.
Yes, it's hard, isn't it?
Yeah. But I very much like the choice of the poem, The Soldier. Oh. So could you just say a bit more about how that choice came about and what made you pick that particular poem?
Okay, about The Soldier. Then I'll tell you about the second one. The first poem is by Humbert Wolfe, who was a civil servant, but he was really quite a well-known poet in his day. I describe him as one of the Georgian poets, that is, people like Rupert Brooke and J.C. Squire and John Masefield, who were writing in ordinary English but still adhering to form and rhyme and so on. They were a sort of... They dropped all the these and thous and things that you had in Victorian poetry, and they were writing in ordinary English but still writing with fidelity to form. And Humbert Wolfe published quite a lot of poems in his lifetime, including translations of Heine and so on. But after his death, he sort of fell out of favour for some reason, in the same way I think most of those Georgian writers did, because they got sort of overtaken by modernists like T.S. Eliot. But I'm a great raider of second-hand poetry departments in second-hand bookshops, and I often buy things on spec. And I bought that little book of Humbert Wolfe's, which it's in, and that was probably the best poem in the book. So it seemed absolutely perfect for what the book I was writing, that's why it's there. It's one of my lucky numbers, that one. It's a great poem, and with Birds Without Wings, I mean for those of you who haven't
you can
read
read
it, it's fun. I can probably know it off by heart. It's just a very short poem by Spyros Kyriazopoulos, who's a poet from Epirus, called The Cat. And it goes like this. She was licking the open tin for hours and hours without realising that she was drinking her own blood. And again, I found the book with this poem in a second-hand bookshop in Lixery on Cefalonia. It was in a little book called Voices from Yanina. And I read it years and years ago, and when I was writing this book, I suddenly remembered it and thought it was the perfect metaphor for what happened in Anatolia, where people who were family were really sort of shedding their own blood in the interests of the great politicians. So it was a lucky find, that one. But Humbert Wolfe has had a volume, his poems have now been republished. Thanks to me having it as at the beginning of Captain Corelli. So that's one little service to literature I've done.
Is this poem too long to read? Sorry.
The Humbert Wolfe. No. Do you mind?
No, please do. And
it's just called The Soldier. Down some cold field in a world unspoken, the young men are walking together, slim and tall. And though they laugh to one another Silence is not broken. There is no sound, however clear they call. They are speaking together of what they loved in vain here, but the air is too thin to carry the thing they say. They were young and golden, but they came on pain here, and their youth is age now, their gold is grey. Yet their hearts are not changed, and they cry to one another, what have they done with the lives we laid aside? Are they young with our youth, gold with our gold, my brother? Do they smile in the face of death because we died? Down some cold field in a world uncharted, the young seek each other with questioning eyes. They question each other, the young, the golden-hearted, of the world that they were robbed of in their quiet paradise. It took me, I mean, I thought that was just absolutely summarised what happened to those young Italian soldiers who ended up being massacred by their former allies.
Hi. I was discussing your book with a fellow juror while I'm waiting to be called. And, when I told that person that your book was going to be translated into film, she immediately went, no, no, no. And I just felt perhaps the medium of the giant screen was not have done justice. I didn't feel it did, but that perhaps more, you spoke about chapters earlier on, now perhaps, you know, several episodes, perhaps a TV version of it would have done more justice to it.
Like The Jewel in the Crown.
Yeah.
But it was a terrific TV series, wasn't it? It was, you know, I'm watching it again.
Yeah,
now.
Something better than the book, son.
Maybe. But a lot of people who've seen the film without reading the book think the film's really great. And that's often the case. People who have read the book have already made their own film in their own minds, so they know what everyone looks like, what they sound like, and so on. And so a film just looks wrong. So it's that much worse for the writer, obviously, because the writer knows the book better than everyone. I'm not entirely hostile to the film by any means. I think the scene where the young Italians were massacred was heartbreaking, and they actually filmed it in exactly the spot where it did happen. You know, you can still find the bullet cases lying around there. But I do have complaints about the film. I think there was a completely senseless sex scene in the middle. Part of the tragedy of the book is they don't manage to become lovers when they're young, you see? And that spoils it terribly. And after the sex scene, the Corelli character just buggers off. It's somewhat inexplicably. Which would have left Pelagia wondering, you know, what she'd done wrong, I think. One of the curious things about the film is that although it's called Corelli's Mandolin, there's hardly any mandolin music in it at all. And if I'd been in charge of the music, I would have crammed it with Beethoven and Hummel and Neapolitan song and things like that.
We should end, and Louis will sign books afterwards,
and helmets, apparently.
And helmets, any other militararia, if there is such a word. And just to thank him very much for coming and talking.
Guardian Unlimited.